Deliverance by Myth by Brianne Holmes, Director of Marketing and Communications at Erskine College. This essay was originally published in the Ivy Leaves Journal of Literature and Art at Anderson University in 2012. Because of my stubborn Peter Pan never grow up complex, I transitioned out of childhood later and more reluctantly than most. At 13, a vague shame overshadowed me when I pulled out my Barbies and sent them upon adventurous quests in the fictional world I had created for them, a world I mapped out on sheets of computer paper, each country carefully delineated in pencil. Yet for all my embarrassment, I couldn't bear to part with my childhood. Then I discovered The Lord of the Rings, J.R.R. Tolkien's three-book fantasy. My first brush with the trilogy came when my parents watched Peter Jackson's film adaptation of The Fellowship of the Ring on their anniversary. By all accounts, my mother spent most of the movie gripping the edge of the couch in suspense while my father snored, his head tilted back against the cushions. My mother told me I would like the movie, but she insisted I read the books first. Then ensued a book fest during which my mother and I borrowed two copies of The Hobbit from the library so we wouldn't have to fight over it. I remember both of us sprawled on my bed reading our separate copies. By the time The Return of the King came out in December 2003, I was an avid fan. For me, The Lord of the Rings had struck a deep and fundamental longing. Through its mythic world of magic and elves and hobbits, I saw something more, something that teased the edges of my brain, whispering of truths beyond the physical and the now. C.S. Lewis experienced something similar in his adolescence when he encountered Siegfried and the Twilight of the Gods, a Wagner opera based on Norse mythology. In his spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis describes the joy this work evoked in him as the stab, the pang, the inconsolable longing. Lewis and I are not alone in our love of myth. Throughout history, people have been stirred by the mysterious workings of mythology. Mesopotamia gave us the first recorded myth, the Epic of Gilgamesh, written some 4,000 years ago. Scandinavia has Beowulf. Greece has the Odyssey, Iliad has the Ramayana, the Arabic regions have 1001 Nights. This begs the question, why does myth attract us? What comfort, what courage, what enlightenment do we seek in the supernatural fictions of mythology? The Lord of the Rings was not my first encounter with myth and fantasy. I grew up with C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia and with the original Star Wars trilogy. But The Lord of the Rings greeted me with something more than my past encounters with fantasy. It delivered that twinge Lewis spoke of, that longing so exquisite it almost hurt. Perhaps timing made the difference. Tolkien visited me during a vulnerable time. I felt the pressure to put away my childhood, yet I was not ready. I was afraid of taking my own journey into the gray mist and rocky terrain of adulthood. That's when myth took my hand. For all of us who feel lost, myth is a guide, a friend who shows us who we are and who we might become. Western culture returned to myth, as I did, in response to an identity crisis. In the mid-20th century, the West grappled with its past and its future. The world wars had shattered lives, redesigned national borders, and rattled the confidence of the last few hundred years. By the mid-60s, the tumult included the Cold War, the Vietnam War, civil rights, women's rights, and youth rebellion. Enter myth. Though The Lord of the Rings was first published in 1954 to 1955, it was not until 1966 that its fame burgeoned when a pirated edition was published in the U.S. Soon, Tolkien's fantasy had a cult following among college students who liked the earthy, genuine hobbits and the pro-environment undertones of the trilogy. In his essay, He Gave Us Back Myth and With It Truth, Chris Armstrong comments that The Lord of the Rings opened the world of myth and mystery to a generation disenchanted with the soulless corporate culture around them. Tolkien's trilogy did not stand alone. Then in 1966, Star Trek premiered on television. A generation struggling for meaning and order took refuge in myth. This is what myth does. It sends us confident warriors, reluctant heroes, and heartbroken wanderers. In them, we see ourselves more clearly. We see our weakness and our potential. Myth also presents us with the human yearning for something more, something beyond the confines of our mortal world. Take, for example, the ancient myth, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Framed against the cloudy sky of Mesopotamian polytheism, the epic presents a hero longing for escape from death. In his lecture on fairy stories, Tolkien called the wish to evade death the oldest and deepest desire, the great escape. Similarly, Mircea Eliade, a 20th century Romanian philosopher, called myth the nostalgia for eternity. When we look across continents and cultures, this is exactly what we find, this longing for something spiritual and lasting. In Gilgamesh, a thirst for everlasting life reverberates on every page. As the hero Gilgamesh treks through the wilderness, he says, "Why should I not wander over the pastures in search of the wind? My friend, the end of mortality has overtaken him. Because of my brother, I am afraid of death." Whether we seek the great escape or ordinary everyday escape, the unreality of myth offers some safety, like a glass window behind which we can look at the world. Tolkien saw this element of escape as positive. In On Fairy Stories, he insisted that escape is evidently, as a rule, very practical and may even be heroic. Who would blame a prisoner for wanting to escape, he argues, and if the prisoner could not escape, the next best thing he could do would be to imagine life beyond the prison walls. This world, in one sense, is our prison because it tends to wall out everything but the tangible and the visible. Realistic fiction can only describe life within the prison walls, addressing the physical and the humanly possible. It plays by the rules of the world we live in. Realistic fiction is certainly important, even necessary. It may be that in order to maintain sanity, prisoners must write about prison. But what if prisoners forgot that life existed beyond the prison? What if they stopped believing there was something beyond their sight? In mythology, we find a grappling with the supernatural or the spiritual. Beowulf fights monsters. Rama and his wife Sita from the Ramayana face demons in physical form and wrestle with the task of sorting through their deceptions. Odysseus and the other heroes of Greek mythology struggle with the gods. Myth does what realistic fiction cannot do. It personifies the spiritual. Hades becomes not just death and not just a place, but a person as well. The curtain splits between our world and another, and demons show their faces. In modern myth, too, spiritual forces take shape. In C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia, evil is often embodied in characters, such as the White Witch and the Green Lady. In A Wrinkle in Time, evil coalesces in the form of the Dark Thing, a blackness slowly enveloping the universe. The Lord of the Rings solidifies evil in the form of a ring. Goodness, in old myth and new, often materializes in the heroes of the stories, not necessarily perfect in goodness, but striving toward righteousness. Myth is necessary, says writer Clyde S. Kilby, because reality is so much larger than rationality. Realistic depictions of the world are necessary and often accurate, but rarely complete. Mythology fills in our view of the world. Something really higher is occasionally glimpsed in mythology, Tolkien once said. Divinity, the right power, the due worship, in fact, religion. C.S. Lewis, as a boy, saw something of this religion in Norse mythology. He saw something there that led him back and back again to myth, and later to Christian writers, some of whom were also mythmakers, and ultimately to God. "Sometimes I can almost think," Lewis said in Surprised by Joy, "that I was sent back to the false gods, there to acquire some capacity for worship, against the day when the true God should recall me to himself." Lewis spoke of false gods. It is true that many myths provide errant interpretation of the unseen. All myths, in fact, are at best incomplete accounts of the spiritual. But most myths are sprinkled with hints of truth, glimpses of the true God. The biblical book of Ecclesiastes says of God, "He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end." No fantasy, no myth will ever be complete because our understanding of God is limited. He is beyond us. C.S. Lewis discovered that the joy he sought, the joy he thought he found in myth, was not, in itself, the thing he desired. Joy, he said, was like a road sign pointing toward Christ. The sensations joy brought him were merely the mental track left by the passage of joy, not the wave, but the wave's imprint on the sand. For all images and sensations, if idolatrously taken for joy itself, soon honestly confess themselves inadequate. All said in the last resort, it is not I am only a reminder. Look, look, what do I remind you of? Myth is not God. Myth cannot fully explain God. Rather, myth calls us to peer beyond our physical surroundings and seek God. As Clyde S. Kilby writes, myth is the name of a way of seeing, a way of knowing in depth, a way of experiencing. That is why we keep writing and filming myth today. Like a pair of glasses, it helps us see. I first read The Hobbit as a child struggling toward adulthood. I rode myth like a wave over the tumult of adolescence. On the surface, it is merely a story of dragons and dwarves and hobbits, magic, fantasy, myth. But in the depths of an engaging story, there is more than this. Out of the corners of our eyes, we see something true. What is it but a glimpse of the unseen, a shadow and a foretaste of the eternal? Here is a parting of the curtain behind which sits the universe of the unpalpable. We catch glimpses of what is beyond. We catch glimpses of God.